So we are at Vanderbilt Law School in Nashville at a meeting on law and biosciences with Glenn Cohen, who is professor of law at Harvard Law and co-director of the Petrie Flom Center for Health Law Policy, Biotechnology, and Bioethics. A big brief there. And our good friend Adam Colbert, who's at the previous Beyond Belief meeting, professor of law at the University of San Diego Law School, but at some point moving to Brooklyn, as I understand it. So we just had a number of sessions, really interesting sessions. You were both in one about enhancement, which we'll get to in a minute. But at the end of that session, there was a question raised about the efficacy, the utility, the importance of neuroscientific evidence in the law, and whether in turn lawyers have somehow had an impact on the neuroscience community in the way it thinks about its construction of experiments and so on. The current issue of Nature, this is the March 18th issue, has an editorial about science in court. There's a big article called Head Case about functional magnetic resonance imaging going into court, whether it's ready to weigh in on the fate of murderers. This is psychopathy. Kent Keel's work and so on. There's some stuff about fingerprinting, some stuff on DNA. There's a current article in Trends in Cognitive Sciences, Neuroscience, Lie Detection, and the Law by Frederick Schauer at Virginia, in which he's basically making the argument that law's goals differ from the sciences. Legal suitability of neural lie detection depends on legal standards and not those determining what good science is. So there's obviously this cross-hybridization going on, but I got the sense in the room that people were saying, I don't know, that in terms of the normative way in which we conduct our business as lawyers, that we should be outsourcing too much of our decision-making to neuroscience. So let me get both of your opinions on that. So Glenn, do you want to kick off?
So I mean, this has always been the case. If you look at psychiatric testimony, we don't need the newfangled fMRI mechanisms in the sense that the questions a law asks in a criminal trial are not the same questions that psychiatry asks. It's not the same questions the fMRI asks. And one of the interests, I think, of this technology and discussion in law schools is that the neuro stuff either means too much or too little. On the one hand, it could radically change entirely our conception of responsibility and get rid of criminal law altogether. And of course, law is not particularly open to that possibility. But once you sort of remove that as a possibility, it's not entirely clear how you operationalize it in specific criminal trial concerns.
I think we have to distinguish two aspects of neuroscience. There's the responsibility side and the technology side. On the responsibility side, I would say probably a majority of legal scholars think that neuroscience won't have a substantial impact because the law does not make an excuse for the fact that our behavior is mechanistic. Neuroscience is explaining how our behavior can be explained by these mechanisms inside our brain, and I think a majority of legal scholars would say that's not going to have an impact because that's not legally relevant. But I do think there's an alternative view. I think some legal scholars would say that as we learn more and more about how we are mechanisms, and as we come to believe this in a more direct way, in a more visible way, people like Josh Green have made this point, that it may affect people because it's going to affect our sort of lay intuitions, and that can filter through in voting and the way our legislators run our country. So that's on the responsibility side where there's a debate about whether or not neuroscience will have much of an impact. On the technology side, I think it's virtually indisputable that neuroscience will have a substantial impact. Exactly which technologies will be important, it's not entirely clear. But certainly all kinds of pharmaceuticals are going to affect how we think, how we concentrate, what we can remember. And these will raise interesting legal issues about eyewitness testimony, about obstruction of justice, about mitigation of tort damages. And then there's the lie detection side. It's not clear when it's going to be good enough for courtroom use, but I think there's a good chance that it will eventually be good enough, and that will have a tremendous impact. And I think that there's a dispute about when the technology is going to be ready. And I'm certainly open to the view that we're comparing two very different things. We've got scientists looking at lie detectors that are looking for things like error rates. How good is it? But we're comparing it to something for which we have very little data about whether it's good or not. and that's the jury system. And so we're kind of in an unfair fight.
So let me just pick up on that one point from Frederick Schauer's paper here. Let me pull out a sentence here. Even if neural lie detection reliability were only 0.6, a level grossly insufficient to support conviction, that level, if supporting a defendant's alibi, say, could raise a reasonable doubt as to guilt. So he's basically saying the other kind of evidence, non-neuroscientific evidence that's admitted in a courtroom, is often not much better than this, and it plainly we're running with that. So why not this?
I mean, I think one issue here really does have to do with the reliability of the technology, and also the appropriate role of different actors in the judicial system. So, for example, earlier today, and as part of this program we've had, we had a discussion about roboticizing the judicial system. Could you have judge robots? Could you have jury robots, right? And one thing which I think would be inappropriate to use this technology to do would be to use something like the result of a lie detection via fMRI as a sort of replacement for the jury. Why rely on the jury as a credibility determinant when we instead have the technology right here? And I think that just most people would say that's not the way our system was designed. That's not the way the Seventh Amendment to the Constitution ensuring a jury trial has this conception of what the role of a juror is. Sure, this can be informative when it meets the standards of the Doebert test and can be admitted as evidence, but
let me interrupt you. Yeah. Sorry, what is that? What test?
It's the Doebert test, so it's the reigning test in evidence in terms of the admission of expert kind of information. And often there are Doebert hearings about things like fMRI technology, about really any technology and any expertise. The judge is supposed to serve a gatekeeping function here to let some techniques in and some techniques out. And usually there's a standard about generalizable acceptance in the community, in the scientific community, and validity. But it's one thing to let this evidence in and have that filter through the jury. It's something quite different to try and replace the jury with any technology, including lie detection technology. It is the province of the jury to determine credibility decisions.
Now, the odd thing there, and this, I'm glad you brought up the discussion about the judges, because there was in Owen's discussion as well, and this notion of roboticizing. The idea of roboticizing was to remove any emotional valence as well, right? And I found it odd that the discussion hermeticized, I mean, kept emotion as a separate entity, as though it were not part of the whole decision-making process of an intelligent system operating the way a neuroscientist understands it, as though you could somehow exclude emotion from this. And there was talk about judges, perhaps, how judges, whether they knew whether their biases were entering things and so on, and perhaps you could exclude that. And then there was a comparison of judges' decision-making capacities. And one had the sense of almost hearing that perhaps there was going to be some sort of a Solomon module sort of suggested by somebody, that judges had this particularly good little device somewhere in their brains that would make them better at deciding people's guilt, innocence, and so on and so forth. Where was all that going? I got a bit lost in the middle of that.
So I don't know what you thought. I'll be curious to know your views on it. But my own sense was we have two kinds of modularization here being imagined. One is the idea that a single decision maker like a judge would try to correct his behavior to try and factor out emotional elements of decision making in favor of rational ones. The other, though, is instead thinking about the function of a judge. A judge does many things in a criminal trial or a civil trial, and taking some of those things and having them determined in a way in which emotion can play little role versus having some elements determined in ways where emotion can play a lot of role. And usually that has to do with operationalizing that as attempts to constrain discretion. So something like sentencing, right? We could have sentencing work the way the old guideline system used to work, which is to say to have a grid. They did this act, these factors, therefore this punishment results. A very different approach would be to have totally unconstrained form of sentencing where a judge just decides what is the right sentence for this particular perpetrator given everything I've heard. And you can think about that as a system that tries to factor out more emotional factors by constraining decision-making authorities. So that's what I thought the basis of the discussion was, as opposed to one that tries to get the judge in every decision he makes to say, unbias yourself. Remember what you are doing.
There is that difficulty that I brought up there of where you, even using language in which you say things like, make a rational decision by excluding emotion.
That's right.
And you know that a neuroscientist would, of course, argue that they're part and parcel of the same process. So that would be a bogus exclusion.
I think at a terminological level, that's right. And this is just another case in which I think the lawyers can learn something from the neuroscientists in terms of the way we speak about these things. But I think there is an interesting question about mercy. Mercy is the idea that I think of here. Mercy is a particular kind of reaction to a criminal act, right? And whether we classify that as a decision that encompasses both rationality and emotional judgment, or whether we instead group it with emotion, I think really this is a debate about whether we want judges and their senses of mercy to have control of what the outcome is versus a system that doesn't leave discretion for exactly that. I didn't know what you thought about the discussion.
I thought there were a lot of moving parts to it. One issue had to do with looking at the way judges make legally related decisions under fMRI and comparing it to the way non-judges make decisions under fMRI and trying to see if there's something different going on in their brains. And there was a suggestion that there really was something going on in the brain. So suppose we had some evidence that said that judges are, you know, more even-handed or less emotional. It raises interesting questions. It's not obvious where we go from that. One possibility is that by virtue of being a judge, it actually changes your brain over time or changes the way you think about problems to make you more even-handed in certain respects. Another possibility is that these are the people that are most interested in becoming judges or the ones that progress and are more likely to receive those positions. So it's not clear which way we'd go with it, but it's certainly an interesting finding, if, assuming it's true.
And what would you think would happen about it if we've had a finding one way or the other? I'm just curious where we take that. So imagine we find the way judges decide these matters in terms of an fMRI scan looks different than the layperson. What follows from that in terms of the intervention in the policy space?
Right. Well, I think first we'd want to find out whether this is a change that happens at the very beginning when they're selected as a judge, or if it's something that only happens after a few years. That would tell us something about causation or not. The second thing we'd want to do is decide, perhaps, whether or not we like whatever it is that judges tend to do. If we think that that's a good thing, whatever we see, then we might say, let's look for brains that have similar features. Now, it's not clear that looking at brains for similar features is any better than what probably would be a much better choice, and that's just to look at judges' behavior. So, I mean, partly, these are questions that are interesting because we're academics and we want to know the way the brain works in a legal context, even if we can't immediately say, here's how it changes the law.
So what you were talking about there, Glenn, was this, all right, you take a group of judges and other people as controls, you follow them through a career as they make decisions and so on, you scan their brains at the end, and if it turns out that reliably, shall we say, there are different patterns in skilled judges' brains than in just their cohort who are not judges, then obviously that sort of decision-making process has produce changes in the brain's actual neural architecture.
Possibly.
To some extent, possibly. And so are you saying that that's a, should we try and identify that what is and then go look for people who've got that neural architecture already? Or
it seems sort of impractical to me, but, you know, ask me in 30 years.
Well, but I mean, let me just push you on this.
Sure.
I'm very interested in this, right? So again, in the jury system, we often think that it's important to be judged by a jury of your peers. So in fact, we wouldn't want people to all have the same neural architecture necessarily. We probably want a diversity. Do you think the judgeship and the benches should be different from that respect, that we want an archetypal type of judge that happens to have a certain neural architecture that we associate with the existing judiciary?
Right, so I'm open-minded as to exactly what behaviors we want to see from judges or from jurors. I only pick up the discussion and say, once we've identified what that thing is, then we can draw a correlation to something we see in the brain, and that might be, you know, interesting, at least from an academic perspective, maybe someday from other perspectives. You could imagine someday, rather than, you know, giving students the SAT, we look at their brain and see what their actual aptitude is. I don't know whether that would be a better, worse, or cheaper, or more expensive way to do it in 30 years from now.
Yeah, when I use the phrase neural architecture, of course, I was not talking about something unmoving like a building.
Right.
I was talking about patterns of representational activity, that was all. Let's talk about something that you two both spoke to today, which is this whole notion of enhancement. Could you gloss the territory for me here? What kind of things are we talking about so that for a layperson?
So many people would say that the boundaries of this concept of enhancement is hard to define. Some people would include treatments as part of enhancement. So if I get a vaccine against HPV, that might be an enhancement on some views, but not an enhancement on others. Also, people would, I think, disagree as to what kinds of interventions count as enhancements. Whether your parents sending you to piano lessons when you are 8 is an enhancement versus genetic manipulation or selecting a pre-embryo that has a certain genetic condition as an enhancement versus some idea of having a prosthetic leg, like this case involving this runner, Pisto, whether that's an enhancement. So we have this very broad territory, and some people think that much turns on narrowing the term enhancement to a small area of that territory. Others think that it's that very act of trying to separate out this small subset that's problematic and gets us in trouble normatively. But I would say all of these might be considered enhancements, and therefore we need further distinctions to try and distinguish those that are troubling to us and those that are not troubling. And it's the burden of those who want to do something about it to try and explain to us why some of the subset is problematic when the rest of it is not.
Yeah, so it's interesting that you had that range in your presentation, because I think most people, certainly naively I, when coming into this, thought enhancement would mean doing something that was absolutely unusual, taking a drug of some kind. The piano lessons, like being a good parent and wanting your child to excel, it just didn't strike me as an enhancement. But you include that on the spectrum.
Well, let me put it to you this way. Imagine that instead of having lessons for a year for your child, there was a pill or a genetic manipulation that could be done that would produce the same result. Doesn't seem to me then that there's much of a distinction between the two. Maybe you think one is earned, but what does it mean to earn? All of this is mediated through the neural architecture, to use your earlier term. So it's not clear to me why merely doing it through biological change rather than learning or practice or something like that should be a distinction that has a lot of weight.
This gets into all sorts of areas as well in terms of resources and who can afford to pay for enhancements. In some of the meetings that I've been doing on this series we have on the Science Network about aging, about diet, nutrition, metabolism, and aging, in conversations with Caleb Finch, with Tuck Finch, he's seeing a future where, as people live longer, as it becomes there will be health elites emerging, because the people who can afford to take advantage of various lifespan enhancements, I suppose you could think of them in that term, will be the people with the resources to do it. So then we get into inequality issues, distributive justice issues, the lawyers again. So this is all your territory, right?
Sure, right. I mean, one way that the distinction sometimes made is to say something like a therapy makes you well and an enhancement makes you better than well in some respect. But as Glenn pointed out, you know, it gets a lot more complicated than that. A difficult case might be, say, a woman who's 50 and wants to have a child. And do we understand the assisted reproduction that she receives as therapy or enhancement? Well, you could say that it's therapy. Here's a person who'd like to do something with her body, but it's just no longer able to do it. And we'd say, we're just giving her this ordinary ability back. But another way to understand it is to say, no, enabling her to get pregnant, that's an enhancement, because that's enabling her to do something that's outside of what she'd ordinarily be able to do at that age. So it is a difficult line to draw, but you're right that it raises interesting issues about changes in distributive justice, changes in who has the ability and the power to do certain things, and that might vary by your ability to pay for healthcare or pay for enhancement services.
But I mean, these access issues, just to sort of further the point Adam was just making, they are in place in the parenting module as well. Take SAT tutoring, right? Again, you could potentially imagine there was a very expensive drug that got you an 800 on your SAT, and there was the same cost module from Kaplan's test prep that gets you an 800 on your SAT, right? In both cases, those who can't afford it are disadvantaged, and it seems to me they're disadvantaged in the same way. And if I'm troubled by one, I'm not sure why I'm not troubled by the other.
Yeah. You also spoke and said, look, I did pretty well at school, let's not say why, let's not pat myself on the back too much, but here I am, I worked hard as well. Who knows what the genetic endowment was, but here's the result. Now, how am I going to feel, essentially you were saying, if somebody can come along who's plainly, at first glance at least, not as smart or as refined as a thinker as I am, takes a pill, and they blow me away. I mean, so how should I feel about that? And you had an issue with that.
Well, you know, so I will say, Roger, it's the first time someone's called me refined in an interview, so I'm very flattered. But so to me, what this does is it exposes the emptiness of the existing meritocratic system, right? In that it's not clear why I deserve my natural talents, especially if they were acquired through no effort of my own. And you might say problematically, and here I'm channeling my old mentor Michael Sandel and his critique of this sort of this kind of argument, he would think this is absurd to say this, but even if I work hard and study hard, that itself might be partially determined by my genetics and partially determined by my upbringing, neither of which I am responsible for. So really, the further you go down this path, the more you come to worry that maybe nobody deserves anything good that happens to them. And therefore, if I was born with a genetic endowment, but someone else can acquire it by consuming a pill, it's not clear why mine is the real one that deserves reward, and theirs is the synthetic, the fake.
Right, but the go ahead, Adam.
Yeah, I mean, I agree with a number of things Glenn said. I'm not sure I would go quite as far, but one thing I'd add to it is that part of what might feel unfair about that situation when Glenn, who studied so hard and worked so hard, is then beaten by the person who takes the pill, is we feel like there's a certain reliance interest. Like, we've grown up in a certain world that set the rules of the game in a certain way, and it might feel unfair if someone finds the shortcut. Now, at the same time, people go through this in the real world all the time, right? They study for years to be, you know, a master carpenter, and then all of a sudden a machine comes out and takes away their job. So I think that there's actually a similarity in those cases, and people might actually feel the same way. You might think it's unfair to the carpenter to lose his livelihood after the rules of the game have been a certain way. Well, same thing. It's unfair to Glenn when all of a sudden someone comes around with a pill that, you know, makes your mental life much quicker and easier.
Oh, it usually happens to the craftsman, the carpenters, that he then hangs on long enough to become deemed a master craftsman, and people go flock to him in boutique, you know, numbers and so on. So.
Right, so meaning the students want the professors who did it the old way, they did it the hard way, the master professor.
It's the distinction between institutions and designing institutions, right? So what's the problem with taking steroids in baseball? The problem is that the rules of baseball say you are not to take steroids, and it's cheating because you are breaking the rules. It's a very different question to ask, would baseball be better? Would it be better to design a new institution, don't call it baseball, call it Roger Ball, call it whatever you like, that doesn't permit prohibit the use of steroids? That's a very separate question that can't be answered by the fact that we have an existing institution that looks like this. And I think your point is the same, that often to the extent there is resentment from the person who cheats, who gets ahead, who breaks the rules, it's because there are rules in the game that everybody else was operating and this person breaks them. Mm. But that's a different question about what the rules of the game right. ought to be in a world where these enhancements are available.
Right. There's an old Saturday Night Live skit of the, you know, all steroid Olympics or something like that. So it's very much like Roger Ball.
Yeah. So thank you. So but there is this word. There's several words kept coming back. Trust was used a great deal. Honor was used. The honor of the system that you're talking about there being abused. The favorite terms of the President's Council on Bioethics, the whole notion of dignity, human dignity. These are terms that are now being still explored in some detail, given the science that goes into them. Which have you given this some thought about the sanctity of these terms and whether in fact they're just antique or they actually convey deep moral values that people should continue to ascribe to?
So I think more often than not, I suspect they're sanctimonious and don't have sanctity, right, to draw that distinction that they are actually covers for illiberal premises that are smuggled in, right? So basically, it's not the case that the ideas which these concepts stand for are ones that everyone can subscribe to in an overlapping consensus. Rather, they represent particular concepts of the good, often quite theistically influenced, and are used in discourse in a way that sort of masks that fact. So I guess I'm relatively skeptical about the use of terms like honor and dignity. I don't think they are contentless. I think they have appropriate usages, but I think often their usage is actually to put forth another idea that the speaker is not prepared to defend in a liberal society. So I'm usually relatively skeptical of the use of those terms, but I think there are exceptions. You know, you can be a Kantian in the sense of dignity that Kant means, I think, is one that has a specific meaning that I can sort of explain and that I can sort of doesn't require subscription to a particular comprehensive theory, perhaps.
I think a lot of the anti-enhancement folks are concerned about the status quo. In other words, a lot of them are arguments for what is natural, for the giftedness of life, or put another way, for the way things are now. Sometimes that's right, because sometimes the way things are now are great, and you can't make it much better, and so that would be an argument, but it's going to very much depend on the context. There's going to be other contexts where we can make it better. So perhaps there will be a drug that will enable us to concentrate better, and that's a great thing. I don't think we want to say that our current concentration levels now are perfect. We could imagine people who had greater concentration abilities than we have now. I don't think that the anti-enhancement people would say, there's something wrong with those people that are super concentrators. They should reduce their ability to concentrate. I don't think they'd say that at all, because what they're concerned about is not so much that our current abilities to concentrate are at the right level, but rather that we should stick with our status quo natural concentration abilities.
Francis, I'll talk to you later, made another point, which is that suppose you then have this wholesale knowledge that an entire nation, with it, which you historically perhaps you've been at war, their entire nation is embarked on a program of cognitive enhancement. I mean, how bashful would you then be in sort of making it very, very available here? I mean, so the context in which these things are happening as well is also hugely important, isn't it?
Absolutely. I mean, one of the concerns about, say, steroid use in baseball is that you might think the game would actually be better. People will hit the ball further, they'll show more impressive athletic ability, but you might say, well, there's a downside, namely the side effects of the steroids themselves. And once you allow steroids in, now you're putting a certain kind of pressure on a person who'd like to play baseball to take steroids. So in the context where the enhancement has bad side effects, and where it's in this sort of competitive situation, there might be very good reasons to prohibit their use. And so if another country was using cognitive enhancers, that might create pressures on, let's say, our country to do the same thing to stay competitive. That might be a bad thing if those cognitive enhancers also involve bad side effects.
And beyond side effects here, I think it's useful to distinguish enhancements that have positional versus absolute value. So something like the SAT may be a good example of positional value. The only reason why an individual should get very good at the SAT tasks or the logic games on the LSAT that we have to write for law school is to get into law school, is to be better than someone else because it's graded on a curve. There are other kinds of enhancement, though, like health, for example, resistance to disease, which you might think are desirable in their own right. They're absolutely good, maybe not completely absolutely good, because we have to worry about population levels and the like, and if everybody lived too long, maybe we'd be in trouble. But for the most part, we think make people better off, irrespective of even if everyone else does it. And maybe that's sort of relevant to your question about thinking about a country that is cognitively enhanced. If their cognitive enhancement were to push us to enhance in a way that's absolutely better for us, that would be different than if it pushes us to cognitively enhance in a way that's only desirable so we can keep up with the Joneses.
One of the other things that I'm thinking about the way in which, going back to the way in which language is used, ordinary day language versus the way some things now have to be at least rethought in terms of what neuroscience tells us. Mallarmé's phrase about the task of the poet being to purify the language of the tribe, I always increase that now and say that's also the task of the scientist, is to try and purify the language or at least amend it and bring it up to date. So if you're talking about, as you often do in here, about things like the self or the individual or agency, how do you deal with the notion of the self? Even William James said that, you know, an individual has as many social selves as there are people he meets and societies with which, so social groups through which he has to navigate. We create different self-representations for different navigating through different social spaces. So already we know that we have kind of different kinds of selves. So how do you have this unified notion of a self and when you're talking about the things that are being acted upon?
So, you know, Clarence Darrow once said, in every lawyer there's the wreck of a poet. And I think so. There is a certain poetry in the way lawyers speak in the following sense, that even a word like self or responsibility or agency has multiple usages in multiple different contexts. And we sometimes trade in the argumentative trade and trying to make a point. We trade and equivocate on those usages to transport an intuition about one usage to a different usage. I think in both of our works, in very different ways, though, the concept of identity and the unification of the self is actually something to be contested, possibly. Both of us are interested in the ways, me more with genetic alterations of pre-embryos to induce deafness or something like that. You, I think, more with forgetting and amnesia and the like, and the idea of responsibility. Both of us are, I think, at least open to the notion that selves can be malleable, and instead the account and the question you have to ask is very functional. Really, when I say, are you the same person, that's a different question when I want to know, am I going to hold you responsible as a matter of law for this act, than it is for me to ask whether you are the same person in the sense of, do you have the same goals, the same lives, have you had a conversion experience, for example. And so I think it's very careful, it's very important to be quite careful about the usage we're using it at. And in fact, the self may be one in some contexts, but many in different other contexts in the law.
Take the case that you dealt with, where you were talking about a lot of the research that's being done, very recent stuff, on memory extinction. Mm-hmm. Extinction of memories that people have found to be way more than unpleasant, just horrendous. But that is nevertheless changing, if you think of the self as being the database. Mm-hmm. You have changed the database. You are a different entity at that point.
That's right. So I think we tend to think of personal identity often as involving two things, having physical continuity, so our bodies, our matters are the same throughout time, but also a kind of psychological continuity, that we have the same thought processes over time also. And when you radically alter someone's memory, I think you are changing an important aspect of their identity. But I don't think that's necessarily problematic. I think there are various kinds of changes to our identity that are good things, that we identify with, that we would encourage. So, for example, Peter Kramer, in Listening to Prozac, talks about people who take Prozac and feel for the first time like themselves, right? So by taking this drug, they've in some sense altered themselves, but they've made themselves in a way that feels more identified, more authentic in some respect. And I think that's also true of drugs that affect our memories, that dampen them or enhance them.
Do you think there's a real term? So I was fascinated to hear you use the term authenticity, right? Because my impression is that you're somewhat hostile to this notion in the President's Council that the problem with neuroenhancers is that it creates a schism between who we really are and who we want to be or who we think we are. And sort of this critique of authenticity is sort of what I normally read from your work. So do you think there's something to this idea of authenticity?
Well, it's a great question. Whether there's something to authenticity in a purely objective sense is an interesting and difficult question. But what I can say more confidently is there's something to the subjective experience of feeling authentic. So you could accept at least that. In other words, whether the person who's taking Prozac who claims, I am finally my truth self, whether they're in some sense wrong about that, they're experiencing something that they find very liberating and very healthy.
And what about a drug that increases the experience of authenticity?
So fantastic question.
What do you think about that? Do you think that there, so it increases subjective effects of authenticity, but in fact, maybe to the extent there really is an objective idea of authenticity, increases the schism?
Yeah, so I think that creates a very difficult value balance between what we might think of as the truth versus things that are pleasant. And I think that one doesn't always trump the other. In other words, there may be cases in which a person's life is so difficult or so unhappy that the authenticity drug could be better for them, even if there's some sense in which that's deceptive or even self-deceptive. But there may be tough cases.
Well, let's take an extreme case. Apotemnophilia, which by derivation means the cutting away of, liking the cutting away of, people who actually feel better after they've had a limb amputated. My colleague Ramachandran at UCSD and Paul McGeoch have done some work on this as well. And it's not some sort of Freudian malady, as you well know. There is quite clearly a connection, or a disconnect, in fact, between one part of the brain and the insula, which results in this feeling of extreme discomfort. And that when the limb is removed, astonishingly, these people then say that they feel complete. The removal of something makes them feel complete. That's a very extreme case, but this is sort of the extreme case of what you're saying, isn't it? Their individual sense of authenticity at that point was rendered by removal.
Right. It's such a tremendous change to a person that it's not something we want to do lightly. I'm no expert on this phenomenon, but it seems to me that if you believe that sex reassignment surgery is acceptable, and that seems to be a pretty wide consensus in this country, then it's hard to make the case that this is so different than that. But I don't know enough about it to say that confidently.
I mean, one area where it is different is arguably disabilities impose costs that are externalized in a way that sex reassignment surgery might not, in terms of disability pay, in terms of accommodation mandates for employers. Now, in my perspective, that may not be a good enough reason to limit access to the surgery to correct apotemnophilia or to deal with apotemnophilia, but at least it is a possible ground of distinction which might make us more worried about this. The other might be that we think that the irreversibility or the cost of irreversibility are greater. I'm not so sure about that. In fact, you know, I'm rather attached to my sex organs, to be perfectly, as I am to my limbs. But it's at least possible to me that someone might have a theory which suggests that change in heart or a difference between time one and time two self here and regret is greater in the apotemnophiliac case. Therefore, a higher level of paternalistic protection is in order. I don't know that that's my theory, but at least I could imagine someone trying to draw a distinction that way.
If you can pin something down to sort of a disconnect between right parietal superior module and insula, and quite clearly show that it's a defect in wiring in a sense, isn't that some use for the neuroscience here in this particular instance? I mean, doesn't that give you a...
Right, so if you had the choice of either eliminating the set of thoughts or removing someone's limb, I think most people would choose removing the desire to remove the limb.
And what about the person who has the aberrant preference on your account, right, who says, no, I prefer to be a person who has this obsessive need to get rid of the limb and have that need satisfied than I do to be this other person who doesn't have the desire at all. It's an interesting question where the state could force them to have, basically say, you can't have either. But if you want, or you can't have the surgery, but you can't have the surgery unless you try this other therapy that changes your identity in some way, right?
And part of what makes that question so difficult is it's hard to know if the response that you're getting is itself some way a is part of the pathology itself. And yeah, I'm not sure.
But what about Jay Aronson's case? I mean, who was specifically saying, look, there's a lot of the things I get from my colleagues at Carnegie Mellon and Pitt. Doing this amazing stuff using fMRI to even be able to predict what word you're going to utter from your fMRI. I don't see how this can really have a serious useful impact in how to solve some of these issues that we've been talking around in the table here.
I mean, one is just the identification of possible treatment pathways, right? So if it turns out the fMRI scan of an apotemnophiliac in the middle of their obsessive episode looks very much like the brain scan of another psychopathology that's well identified and has a well-established treatment regimen, one thing you can draw from that, it's a minor thing, but it's important, is that perhaps you ought to try this class of drugs used for that to treat this individual. That might not be something that was obvious to you if you didn't do the fMRI, especially if the symptoms of the two psychopathologies are quite different.
And I shall try and ask him about this, because he specifically said, there was a specific case where we were talking about being rather tired of these cases that one reads in the literature all the time, the cases of the pedophile who had a cyst, and so on and so forth, and you found this out by the diagnostic procedures. He basically said, I don't care how we knew about this, I just want the man off the street. That would be a fairly standard response from a lot of people. But is this not some utility, you think?
I think it depends very much on what you think, and you know more about this than I do, what you think the function of the criminal justice system is. So if you believe in deterrence, you're a consequentialist about it, it doesn't matter why the person does behavior X. What matters is removing them from doing behavior X, incarceration, or, you know, that's what matters. On the other hand, if you think the criminal justice system is actually punishing people because they deserve, in some sense, to be punished, it might or might not make a significant difference to you.
Your thoughts on that, Adam?
Yeah, I think that's right. It's a huge debate among criminal legal theory people between retributivists and consequentialists. And throughout the law, we do draw all sorts of distinctions between what sorts of behavior can be criminalized, in which you might go to prison, and which sorts of behaviors at most can lead you to be civilly committed. And importantly, to put you in prison and to receive that stigma, we generally require you to have engaged in some act in a culpable sort of way. That's the way the system is. That's the way it's been for a very long time. I don't think that's the only view. I think we could imagine a very different system, but it's just not the one that we have.
And just to sort of illustrate this point, there's a famous Supreme Court case, the name escapes me now, maybe Jones, I can't remember its exact name, involving a guy who shoplifts and makes the mistake of pleading insanity as his defense. And he is put into civil commitment, and he's put into civil commitment for 10 or 15 years, I think, by the time he challenges before the Supreme Court and says, listen, the punishment for shoplifting would have been minor. It would have been 3 months, 6 months. I've now been held in civil commitment for a much longer period of time. Surely that must trample on my due process rights. And no, says the Supreme Court, we are not punishing you. We are simply civilly committing you. Two totally different things. Not a retributivist act. It's not what you deserve for being punished. It's merely a conclusion that you are a danger to yourself or others, and therefore the fact that the bellwether of punishment would have been 6 months is irrelevant. So there really is these two very different goals of the criminal justice system and the civil commitment system, but there are some forms of criminal punishment, I think, that kind of dance between the two.
I can give you a flip side example that some of the retributivists have given, in particular Michael Moore. Imagine a person who commits some kind of terrible sex offense, but then there's something that happens, some treatment. So for example, they've had some kind of chemical castration or some kind of actual castration, so we don't think that they're going to commit the offense again, and we have some other sets of reasons to believe that they're not going to engage in criminal behavior again, that they're going to be law-abiding. In that case, a lot of people still have the intuition that that person should be punished. But the way the example is set up, it's supposed to remove the kinds of utilitarian consequentialist reasons for punishment. We're not trying to deter this particular person. We're not trying to incapacitate them because they're no longer a danger. And we create some sort of sham punishment so that other people think he was punished so that they don't engage in the behavior. Nevertheless, a lot of people still have a retributive intuition.
Could you, between you or one after the other, sort of give me for my usual general audience here, which may not be familiar with this entire sweep of legal thinking, and it's philosophical as well, justice ideas. I mean, as I understand it, at one extreme you have a very strict utilitarian consequentialist view of the universe. At the other extreme, well, not perhaps neither extreme, but you have a softer version, if you like, a Rawlsian view of things. And then in the middle, Amartya Sen has come forward with something which is more about human capabilities. They don't quite fit on a spectrum like that, I know. But could you gloss those views for me?
I mean, consequentialists are committed to the idea that the good precedes the right. What is the right thing to do? It's that which maximizes good states of the world. Most of them are committed to an idea of aggregation, that we should take individuals, that sort of my good and Adam's good should be added together, right? And I benefit a lot and Adam benefits very little. Utilitarians would say, as long as the sum of the two is high, that's a good thing versus the other two. People like John Rawls believe in the difference principle. They are prioritarians. They believe in priority to the worst off. And therefore, says Rawls, we should design institutions to maximally benefit the least well-off individual. Whereas the strict utilitarian, he doesn't care what an individual's position in the social order is. Each shall count for one and no more than one. Sort of kind of juxtaposed against that distinction are deontologists, who often say there are things that make the world better, good states of the world that maximize it, and yet we have side constraints. We have an option sometimes of not maximizing the good states of the world, and sometimes we are required not to do that which maximizes good states of the world. The Sen-Nussbaum theory comes from a different philosophic tradition, an Aretaic tradition, a kind of Aristotelian tradition that has to do with what is the nature of an individual, what makes individuals, human beings, flourish. And from that derives this notion of capabilities as sort of something like that. So I really think of them not so much as a spectrum, but different positions. I don't know if you had anything to add on that.
I mean, it's such a huge question that it would be hard to encapsulate it, so I think that was great.
So how would you what you know about neuroscience and how neuroscience operates, how would you correlate them with any of those three positions?
I'll leave that one to you.
Well, sure. I mean, one of the things that I've been writing about lately is what I call the experiential future of the law. And the idea there is that neuroscience is going to tell us a lot more about people's subjective experiences, things like their level of pain, their level of emotional distress, their level of anxiety. And this is really important to lawyers for all sorts of reasons, right? When it comes to damages, we try to estimate these things now, but we don't do a very good job about it. Now, that's one of the reasons it's interesting to lawyers. If you're a utilitarian, a traditional utilitarian, and you believe that what's good are things like states of pleasure as opposed to states of pain, then this might be very exciting for you because this gives you a much better method, in some cases at least, of trying to maximize pleasures over pain. So that might be one way in which a utilitarian, a classical utilitarian, would be very excited about what I call the experiential future.
One big problem for utilitarians is interpersonal utility comparison, right? So how does him being happy compare to me being happy in terms of this global aggregative sort of thing? So I don't know whether you think the subjective experience and the ability to detect subjective experience will help with interpersonal aggregation or just with intrapersonal within a person between two time frames.
I think that it's extremely difficult to make interpersonal comparisons of utility, but it's probably not impossible. So suppose that Glenn and I were both victims of some tort, and now there's a lawsuit that follows, and we're seeking damages. The jury has to decide how much money Adam gets and how much money Glenn gets. And it's very difficult, but they're going to watch us, they're going to see how we move, they're going to see what the doctors say, what the evidence is about our injuries, and they're going to make some determination. And I think that they're making some kind of interpersonal comparison of utility. They may get it wrong, they may not be using the right evidence, they may not be using it the right way, but that's at least what they're trying to do, even though it's difficult. So I think we can do it to some extent, even if we're not very good at it.
And just to be precise, it's worth noting that the kind of utilitarianism Adam's talking about, hedonistic utilitarianism, is just one subset.
Absolutely.
There are others who are desire satisfaction theorists, others who think it's an objective list, and some people who call themselves welfare utilitarians, although that term is used in different ways, who think there's some authenticity requirement on top of it. It's not just having a pleasant brain state, so an electronic or electric stimulation to my brain that produces this pleasant sensation is not enough. It has to be bound in some ways to reality, which I guess brings us a little bit full circle back to the President's Council and their concern with authenticity.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I agree with that comment. So you might be a classical utilitarian who thinks that all that matters are these experiences like pleasure and pain.
So excuse me, we're talking about Jeremy Bentham and
that's right.
John
that's
Stuart
right.
Mill, basically, right?
In particular.
Yeah.
And so now there might be these other sorts of utilitarians or consequentialists who include lots of things on the list. I think that most of them, if they have a good theory, are going to include things like happiness as among the things that are important. And so they should be concerned about the experiential future also because they're going to be concerned about happiness among lots of other things.
All right. But so a number of you, the people in this room, have spent some time at courses where judges are essentially getting neuroscience boot camp. Is this intersection, despite what we've just been talking about and despite some of the possibly limited value of the application of neuroscience to actual normative legal judgments and so on, do you think that's a good movement? Can you see how it can be improved? Is this something that you applaud? I mean, what's your position on this?
So I think it's great, the MacArthur Foundation, AAAS, yeah. Their activities in this respect. Even if you were the most skeptical person on earth about this research, I think it would still be very profitable because we have defense lawyers and also prosecutors for that matter who will try to bring this thing in. And it'll be up to the judge to have these Daubert kind of hearings and also to think about what they want the jury to hear, what they want themselves to hear, what's in chambers, what's going to be excluded. And I think even if you're skeptical about the utility of this science, it's good to be able to teach them what they should be most skeptical about, what they should be least skeptical about. I'm not that skeptical about it. I think I'm somewhere in the middle, maybe closer to the skeptical end. I don't know how we compare on this question, but I think even if you are extremely skeptical, this is a great intervention and one that should continue. Also, I'll just say that the feedback is in two directions. It allows the judges to tell the researchers what are the kinds of applications and kind of things that really would be useful for them. So it allows the judges, in some sense, to help set the research agenda for the researchers, which is wonderful.
Okay, one last question, because I know you've got to go. We'll pick this up and continue at some other time, because there's lots of other issues. But here's one question that I ask a lot of people. In his inaugural address, the president said that he wanted to restore science to its rightful place. He gave no coordinates for this. So from your position as lawyers who think about neuroscience as well, can I press you on what you think the rightful place of science is in this particular society?
Yeah, I'll let you go first.
That may be bigger than the question of describe all moral philosophy in 1 minute.
He did it.
That's
badly,
yeah.
Perhaps, but
I mean, I think that what do we do as lawyers is and as law professors, we're trying to understand human behavior, how people interact, and how to get them to interact in better ways. There are lots of interesting philosophical and analytical questions involved in that, and that's really important. At the same time, unless you know how the world really works, your hands are tied to a large extent. There are all these fundamental, really important empirical questions about how people interact, how do they make the decisions the way they do, and if we don't know those things, we can't set up society in the right way. So I think it's absolutely very important to what we do and to what interests all of us.
I will say something similar, which is that I think of moral philosophy and law as often having an if-then structure. If the following descriptive claim is true, then the following normative claim should follow. This is the way we should do something. The normative, is often what we as lawyers traditionally fight about, what moral philosophers fight about. But that normative, you often only get there if you already know the answer to the description. Is the if satisfied? And just to give an example from my own work, I've got a study where we're looking at whether in vitro fertilization, whether subsidizing that decreases adoption rates in America. There's both an if question, does it have this negative effect on adoption, and a then question, even if it has that effect, what should follow from that? And here I'm working with a social scientist to try and satisfy both the if part and the then part. And I tend to think science is excellent at the if part and some of the then part, but mostly that's what we do. We rely on science to satisfy the descriptive condition.
Good. So, Clay Cohen, Adam Colbert, thank you very much, and let's continue this some other time.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Yeah.